The Book Nook on WYSO is presented by the Greene County Public Library, with additional support from the Clark County Public Library, Washington Centerville Public Library, Wright Memorial Library, and Dayton Metro Library.
Hello, welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and I'd like to welcome to the program Michael Carita. He joins us on the telephone in Bloomington, Indiana. Hello, Michael.
Thanks so much. Appreciate it.
Michael, you've got a new novel out. It's called How It Happened. And from what I'm understanding, this is something that goes way back to the beginnings of your career as a writer. You have had this story kind of on the back burner, haven't you?
Yeah, it actually, the story, or the inspiration for the story, is one that I've been thinking about now for more than half my life. And it kind of started when I was 17 years old. A 19-year-old girl in my hometown in Bloomington went out for a bike ride on a beautiful spring morning. It was a Wednesday morning at about 9:30. And she disappeared, and they found her bike on the side of the road near where I grew up. And so our neighborhood, you know, we had roadblocks and police searches going on, and it was, you know, just a very vivid memory that I was also convinced, I think, like a lot of people in the community, would hopefully be brought to a swift resolution. And by the time I was working for the Bloomington newspaper as a reporter, I was covering the story, and they were searching for Jill's body. They had rumors and theories, but no arrest had been made. And then a local woman offered a confession that was very detailed and kind of gave this horrific account of a being one of three people involved in a drunk and drug-fueled hit-and-run, and that confession was later recanted. But it was the memory of both, you know, living that experience as a kid and then writing about it as a reporter has always stuck with me, and I finally figured a way in to this novel.
We can't say that much more about that particular real crime, can we? Because it'll give away a lot about what happens in your novel.
Yeah, the reality of that crime is, I think, probably only really touched on in the opening pages. You know, the confession is very similar. But one of the challenges I had with the book, and I think a reason that I waited so long to write it, was that I needed to feel the right distance so that I wasn't creating a novelization of this family's true tragedy, but that I was writing, you know, about fictional characters in a fictional world. And one of the ways that I think I succeeded in getting that distance was by changing the setting from this Midwestern college town to coastal Maine, and I think the actual distance helped me begin to see it as a more of a wide open canvas.
Well, it certainly gave you freedom to make a completely different kind of story. The situation in Maine, there's so many elements there that you're not going to find in Indiana. My guess is Michael Carita, his book is How It Happened. I'm just curious, did they ever solve the murder in Bloomington?
Yeah, there was a conviction in, I think, 2006 or 2007, and that has been upheld through several appeals, and he remains in prison.
So it took a long time. And this is a standalone, right? You've written a number of other books, but this one isn't connected to any other story that you've done.
Right. This is a complete standalone.
Michael, I was interviewing Alifair Burke recently again.
Oh, sure.
For her novel, The Wife. And a lot of times when I talk to a writer that I admire, I'll say, well, what are you reading? What are you excited about? And she goes, oh, you've got to talk to Michael Carita.
Oh, I appreciate that. Alifair,
yeah.
She's a great writer. And The Wife was, you know, that was doing it's a great book, and I was very happy to see it having such success this spring.
Very prescient story from Alifair. And she said, oh, yeah, Michael Carita, you haven't, if you haven't interviewed him, you need to. And so she gave me the tip because I had been aware of you and I had not read your stuff. And I'm so glad that she turned me on to it because this is really a page turner. That's how it happened. Wow.
I appreciate that. And I'm glad you let me know because I can thank Alifair for that.
Well, that's kind of how it rolls in this, I hate to call it a genre, but I get reading tips from other writers all the time, and they're always turning me on to new books that they like. It's great.
Yeah, exactly.
And at the end of the interview, I'll ask you for your list.
Okay, terrific.
Okay. So without giving away too much, set the story scene. Let's get this storyline going for our listeners. What happens? Who are these people? What are they doing?
So our protagonist is a man named Rob Barrett, who he's an FBI agent with a specialization in confessions and interrogations, but he hasn't really been tested in the real world yet. He has an academic pedigree and a very elite background in terms of his education and knowledge base, but he hasn't actually been out there working a case. And so when he solicits the confession at the beginning of the book, he looks at this as his first real victory. And when the confession proves not to hold up, you know, the entire game is changing on him, and the price he pays professionally and personally for getting it wrong is pretty steep. And he eventually comes back to Maine to try to see this one through.
He kind of screws up, doesn't he?
Yeah, that's, you know, what I wanted to write. I think we all enjoy flawed protagonists, but I've also all read a lot and written a lot of books about the savvy, experienced investigator, detective who's always a step ahead, you know. And what I wanted to write with Barrett was, let's look at a guy who doesn't have the experience and is not a step ahead and try to maybe get a little deeper emotional connection to the actual task of a detective, particularly when they don't have any experience, when they're just coming in.
I think some of us also like a cop who goes a little bit rogue, and he does that. And in fact, some of that action takes place in a very seedy tavern that is connected to his family. And I love this location. I think this is a very important kind of location in your story.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So the bar is called The Harpoon, and it's in a fictional town of Port Hope, Maine. But I spent a lot of time in these two little fishing villages, Tennant's Harbor and Port Clyde, Maine. And so that's sort of the visual I have there. But Rob spent summers in Maine when his grandfather ran this bar, and his grandfather was a very violent guy, you know, loud and domineering, and kind of looked down on Barrett's father, who was an academic. And I like the situation that allows me to create some internal tension for the character that mimics the external tension of the plot. And so his relationship with the town and his memories of his grandfather obviously are very central to his character.
And apparently, Michael, Maine is undergoing some of the same crisis conditions that we're experiencing here in Ohio and there in Indiana with the opioid crisis. And this is part of your story as well.
Yes, and I'm glad you mentioned that because really was driven home to me while I was working on this book. And I would be in Maine and reading article after article of just, you know, the horrors of this. And then I'd come back to Bloomington, my hometown, and I would see the same thing. And I would travel and pick up newspapers. You know, all my family is from Cleveland, Ohio, originally, and I was watching the toll it was taking in Ohio. I was looking at that, and in Maine, the locals have a phrase for visitors. You know, if you're not a Mainer, then you're from away. And I thought there was good potential to sort of play with that turn of phrase and to address this drug epidemic, because one of the reasons it is such a dire problem in Maine and in rural areas, certainly in Ohio and Appalachia, is simple supply and demand. You know, a dealer can get more money in a place where they don't have as much competition, and so it's really reached out into these rural areas. But what you also don't have there are you have overstretched police departments, and you have almost nothing in the way of addiction resources. And it is, I mean, it's a very difficult addiction to beat for anyone. But when you are in a hard-working, you know, these lobster fishing kind of conditions, and you're 225 miles from the nearest detox or rehab clinic, and you're in a culture where people don't talk about their problems, it can really be devastating. And I've seen the effects of that in some of these towns in Maine.
That came as a surprise to me. I don't know much about Maine. I know there's a lot of fishing that goes on there, but I was not aware that the fishing industry had this drug problem.
Yeah, the Portland Press Herald did a great series looking at it last year. And, you know, when you think about it, it is the most bruising and battering of professions. I mean, you're up before dawn to go out in rough water and haul traps and then get back to the dock. You've got to unload these things, clean the boat. I mean, it is just, it is a grueling process day after day. So you're dealing with people who have real pain.
Mm.
And, you know, the drug allows them to, it pushes the pain aside, but then obviously it creates this very dangerous spiral. And it's something that a lot of the fishermen up there don't like to talk about. Others are very open about how frightening the problem is right now. So it was something I definitely felt that I should address.
And one of the things that people say that want to legalize these illegal drugs is that it would remove the danger of bad batches. Now, obviously, a lot of people are going to argue with that whole argument, but there's a lot of bad batches of drugs out there, and that's another part of your story.
Right. Well, I mean, you've definitely seen in Ohio, and we've seen in West Virginia and Pennsylvania and in Maine where, you know, these users think that they're getting something with a certain level of potency, and then you introduce these chemicals, carfentanil being a primary example, into the mix, and the potency goes up by, you know, 1,000 times, and they don't know that, and the death toll from a drug like that can be just staggering in a matter of days.
Is that the animal anesthetic? Is that the one that?
Yeah, it was actually an elephant tranquilizer.
Right. Okay.
I believe that's.
Whoa, unbelievable! Can we talk about the crime at all?
Yeah, by all means.
Okay, tell us about the crime.
We have two young lovers, and one is a local, and she grew up in this village of Port Hope, and is very close to her father, who raised her as an only father. He was widowed, and her name's Jackie Pelletier. And dream is to be an artist on one of these islands off the coast of Maine, and then she meets a kind of idealistic young law student from Virginia named Ian Kelly, and they're supposed to meet at sunrise in one of her favorite places to paint, and they disappear from that place. And for months, the investigation goes on and on and on, and there are no good leads. And then a local addict and kind of petty criminal named Kimberly Crapo gives a confession that she was one of the people who was involved in the murders, and she promises Barrett she can tell him exactly where the bodies will be found. And he sends in a dive team, and they come up without any bodies, and then someone sends an email with precise GPS coordinates identifying the real location of the bodies 212 miles away.
You're listening to 91.3 WYSO, giving voice to our community, our nation, and our world since 1958. It's the Book Nook. My guest is Michael Carita. His new one is How It Happened. And you have a criminal mastermind in this one, and I love it. We're not going to say who he is or anything, obviously, but wow. He's a slippery little devil.
Yeah, thank you. I really enjoyed. I'm trying to figure out how to explain this without giving spoilers, but his view of the world became pretty intriguing to me, and I saw a lot of potential to develop the plot, but also work him against the other characters in the book by getting to know his sense of the world.
You also do a really good job of making FBI agent, would you call him an agent, Barrett?
Yes.
You make him very likable. We are very sympathetic with him, and we want him to succeed. Sometimes the protagonist isn't that likable in this genre, but he really is. We really like this guy.
I'm glad to hear that. I think hopefully one of the reasons for that connection and the sympathy and the idea that you're rooting for him is that you get to see him fail. You know, he opens with he is very emotionally invested in bringing closure to these families, and when what he promises as closure is revealed to be anything but that, I would hope that the reader really does connect with him. That's always, my goal, my hope.
And I hate to bring this up, but it's kind of a love story in a way, too. I don't know if that was your intent, but he has this love interest, and she actually plays kind of a big role in the story.
Yeah, she is. Liz Street is a reporter who Barrett has known since his summers when he was going up there as a kid, and she really just stepped on the page to me and became she redirected the action in a lot of ways, and she deepened, I think, his character, and I really became a fan of her. And when I say that, I know it sounds strange because theoretically I created her, but it never feels that way. When things are going well, it always feels like the characters are surprising you. And I learned a lot about Liz that I did not anticipate going in, and she really set the tone for some key elements of the book.
You've been doing this for a while, and I understand that this was a dream you've had since your teenage years. When did you first decide this is what you wanted to be, a novelist?
You know, I'm one of the, most boring people in the world because it's all I ever wanted to do. I mean, from the time I began to read, I wanted to write books. And so it goes back to, when I was 8 years old, I was writing letters to my favorite childhood authors and just trying to make contact with them and ask questions, really. I would send them these letters trying to pick their brains and understand, how they've been able to make this into their profession. And it was just, it struck me then, and it still strikes me every day as, a dream of an occupation to be able to tell stories and make a living doing it. So I'm very fortunate.
Okay, Michael, I need names. Who wrote back and who didn't?
I put so many out there, I don't know that I could even be fair and saying who didn't write back.
Okay.
But one who did write back right away was a guy named Bill Wallace, who wrote children's stories that tended to feature animals. But he wrote back and was very, very kind and gracious. And then there was one that a letter arrived just after the writer died. His name was Keith Robertson. And his son responded to it. And I kept in communication with his son for years. In fact, not that long ago, I was still in touch with him, and so that became he was a pen pal and a writing mentor of sorts over the years. And he wasn't even the writer in question, but he was very generous to me.
You talked about the original idea, how this crime happened in Indiana that has been simmering in the back of your mind and finally turned into the theme of this book. And I saw in the notes about it that your publisher sent that you were working on your first crime novel around the same time that this is going on, and you were also reporting for a newspaper. I see in your bio you also have in your background a private investigator. Is that right?
Yeah, that was actually my day job until I was able to go to writing full time. I left the newspaper and I was a PI slash novelist for a while. But that came out of a high school internship, and I went from an intern to a part-timer to a full-timer. And when you talk about jobs that were great grist for the mill, you know, every day there it was an education in the sort of books that I wanted to write from a procedural standpoint, but also it put me in contact with a lot of different people. And I think that was very helpful, just, you know, seeing the way people respond to adversity and obstacle was a very useful education for my writing.
Were you a private investigator in Indiana?
Yes, in Bloomington.
What stuff were you doing? What was a typical day like for a private eye in Bloomington, Indiana? Were you, like, trying to take film of people cheating on their spouses? I mean, what kind of stuff did you do?
Yeah, that's about the only thing I didn't do, really. My boss was he didn't like taking those cases, and he was in a good position where he didn't need to. So we worked for a lot of different law firms, and the great thing about being in kind of a middle market, you know, Bloomington, this area is around 100,000 people, and we would range outside of that, but it was just big enough that we saw a really wide variety of cases, and small enough that you didn't really have to narrow your specialty. And so I worked everything from custody investigations to elder fraud to a few wrongful death cases, insurance fraud, accident investigations. I ran the gamut, and that was great. So I spent a lot of time in a surveillance car, did a lot of interviews, you know, a lot of public records research. So I really had, I think, a uniquely good opportunity as a PI just because of the size of the community and how well established the firm was when I came along.
You're describing literally staking out somebody, sitting in your car waiting for them to come out, just watching, that kind of thing?
Oh, yeah. We did a lot of that. I spent some, you know, fun August days when it's 100 degrees and you're sitting in your car with the windows up for 12 hours hoping somebody moves and no one does. And then I also had some very fun ones when you're running two-car surveillance on rural roads and trying not to lose your subject, but also not to be burned and have them notice you. So it was I always enjoyed surveillance.
And I'm picturing the things that you might have seen and encountered and how these things pop up in your stories years later where you remember something that you saw or that you observed. And I'm wondering what your process is. How do you get ideas for stories? How do they germinate? How do you do it?
You know, it usually comes from a character and a scenario. I'm unable to outline, so I just have a starting point. Setting's very important to me. I need to feel like I'm connected to the place. But I don't have, you know, there's no real process there that I say, well, this is how I go about finding the next one. They kind of announce themselves to me, and then I try them out. And if they work, you can feel that pretty quickly. And otherwise, if you end up fighting a book for the first 50 pages, 100 pages, then I think it's a good idea to let that one go. Mm. And, you know, maybe you'll come back to that idea with fresh eyes and fresh perspective, or maybe not. But it's sort of a hit-and-miss process for me.
I got the impression from your description of how you were dealing with the character development in this new book that sometimes the characters just kind of take over and just sort of write themselves.
Yeah, I think if it's going to be any good at all, then that's the way I need to feel about it. I mean, I need to feel surprised and very emotionally connected and engaged with the characters. You know, readers are not going to feel engaged by a story if the writer didn't feel deeply engaged when he was writing it. And for me, that usually comes from the process of expecting a character will do one thing and then seeing them do another. And those are the best days at it. You know, when the character throws a curveball at me, that's when it becomes a lot of fun.
My guest is Michael Kurita. His new novel is How It Happened. It's a standalone thriller. Are we going to see this character again?
You know, I have no firm plans for him, but I would say that I look at him and I think, okay, he's a young guy with some expertise, and he's got to be up to something, right? So Who knows? Right now I think he could use some recovery and rehabilitation time.
True. Well, I really enjoyed it, and it's the first of your books that I've read, so I need to dip into your bibliography. What are some of the other books that you've done?
You know, the best-selling ones, probably there's a book called The Prophet that is set in Ohio, and then Those Who Wish Me Dead, which is a thriller that's set in Montana, which is another place that I love to write about. So those are probably the bestsellers, but I've written, this is my 13th book, so I've got a decent body of work out there behind me now, which is kind of stunning to think about, but it snuck right up on me.
Nice. Well, Michael, we're at the point in the interview where I need to pick your brain. What are some hot books that you've read lately, some books that you really enjoyed?
I'm thinking of A Lot of Galleys, and I don't want to talk about books that
no,
aren't
go ahead.
Out yet.
Go ahead.
Oh, okay.
Alifair told me about your galley. It's fair.
True. So Megan Abbott, I think, is a really good suspense writer, and she has her new one. It comes out in, I think, July.
I'm jealous. Excellent. I'm jealous you've read that. They haven't sent me one.
Yeah, she's terrific.
Yeah.
And the book doesn't disappoint. I just read a galley of a novella that Stephen King will have in the fall called Elevation, and I really liked that because it's a very different book from him. It's more of a Stand By Me or The Body type of story as opposed to, you know, crime or horror, but I really enjoyed that one. And then there are writers who I just can go back to over and over again and never be disappointed by. Daniel Woodgerell, I think, is you know, what is a fantastic writer. I can't wait to see what he does next. Stuart Onan is another writer who goes, he doesn't write mysteries, but he goes in all sorts of different directions, and they're all very, very rewarding. And then the book that, you know, I'm kind of pushing in everyone's hands right now is Killers of the Flower Moon.
Oh, yeah.
It was a big nonfiction hit last year, but I thought that was just sensational.
I agree. Well, Michael, it's been a pleasure having you on the program.
Oh, thank you so much. I appreciate you taking the time to do this.
My guest has been Michael Kurita. His book is How It Happened. You've been listening to The Book Nook on WYSO. For The Book Nook, I'm Vic McCunis. Thanks, as always, for tuning in.